Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studios in Beijing. I am Jeremy Goldcorn, hosting solo today as Kaiser is celebrating his lovely daughter's birthday. Today, our guests are two old friends of Seneca. Welcome back to the show, Li Xin, managing editor for Caixin, China Economics and Finance magazine. Great to see you, Jeremy.
Thanks. Good to be here again.
And we have Will Moss, the, dare I call him, a PR expert.
You dare.
Okay.
And it may not be correct, but you dare.
I dare. And the blogger behind Image Thief, and also the new group blog, Rectified.name, which we've recommended before on this podcast.
What a week it's been.
What a week in China news. The astrophysicist dissident Fang Lijie died in the United States. And, of course, there has been the continuing fallout from Chongqing. Bo Xilai was removed from his seat on the Politburo, and an official announcement was made of that, and also an official announcement that his wife, Gu Kailai, referred to in the reports as Bo Gu Kailai, is under investigation for the murder of Englishman Neil Haywood in his hotel room in Chongqing. What a week. Li Xin, you just got back from Chongqing, so can I just ask you, how is the weather in Chongqing?
The weather was good. When I was there, it was really sunny, no rain. It reminds me more of Beijing than the typical Chongqing, which was rainy, foggy, and dark and gloomy. Yes.
That's a very good cryptic Chinese media answer. What were you doing down there?
That was Qingmingjie, the tomb visiting festival holiday. So I was actually doing the ritual, visiting relatives and going to visiting the tombs as well. And of course, we chatted about the current affairs a little bit with relatives and friends there. And to my surprise, people come with all different reactions to this. Most vivid memory of that was my friend working for the public security. As the police woman actually said, she lit fireworks when she heard the Wang Lijie incident, because that means the end of the basically 24-hour on-call, tons of overtime work, and unpredictable boss.
Wow, interesting. So, you know, the reports that we've seen of some people being unhappy about it, there are also other people who are very happy in Chongqing.
It's very divided. I mean, people working from the private business sector definitely celebrated. And by those, I mean, not necessarily the grassroots, but who are neither in business nor in the government actually liked what Bo did down there. Because it's very visible in Chongqing, to be honest. You can see all the trees, you can see better public security, more safety down there, and you can see more public affordable housing. It's the benefits is rare. The benefits is real. It's felt by the people down there. But for those working in the government, and they have a different opinion.
And that's...
especially people who care about public affairs, who sort of think longer, think what the real damage that has been done, have a different opinion.
And are people talking about what's going on now?
Yes, they do, but more guessing.
It's all guessing. Everybody's guessing. Yeah. I mean, the phrase I've heard the most in the last week from... almost exactly the same phrase from Chinese and Americans is, this is like a TV drama. This is like an American TV drama. This is like a film. This is like a crime story.
I subscribe to that point of view. I'm waiting for the novelization of the whole thing to come out. Then maybe we can find out what happened, or at least some version of it.
Yeah. So until that, let's end the speculation and move on to our first mini topic today, which is... bank profits. So bank profits, Chinese banks are making a profit, it seems, and this has been in the news. And there are different opinions as to what's going on. And Lisa, you've been doing a bit of research and writing about this topic. Why are bank profits in the news now in China?
Because it's big. I mean, last year, all the banks made 1 trillion yuan in net profits, and that was 36% year-on-year rise from the year before. So that was really huge. Give you one example to conceptualize it. The Construction Bank of China basically makes $27 million US as net profit every day, every single day.
How much profit does Apple make?
I don't know. I didn't count. Where do you know?
I don't. Off the top of my head, I would hesitate to match those numbers up against each other.
Yeah, sorry, that was a random thought. Let's steer back. So they're making a lot of profits. Are those real, though? Isn't there some doubt as to the fact that they may be cooking the books?
That's real, but people are some people are outraged by that. It's because the Chinese economy is obviously slowing down, and you can see that the private sector feels they've been squeezed, especially given what happened in Wenzhou last year, the falling out of the capital chain of the Wenzhou private lending, stuff like that. But the banks, on the one hand, they don't lend money to the smaller business, and on the other hand, they're making a huge profit. And it seems like they are not injecting blood to the real economy as they are supposed to. So that's why people feel a little angry about this. And also, Wen Jiabao actually made a comment, Premier Wen Jiabao made a comment that that's due to the monopoly, which was hitting the right target but using the wrong argument. Because, I mean, how many numbers of companies you need in one sector to really call that a monopoly?
Well, how much of the profits you're talking about, forgive me, I'm ignorant on this whole issue, but the profits you're talking about, how much of that is concentrated in the big four best-known state banks? I know that there's a bunch of other, there's municipal and provincial-level banks, and there's a smattering of private banks, but how much of the profits are being made by the big boys?
More than half of that from the big boys, and also more than 80% of that is basically by the policy that the rigid interest spread between the deposit and loan interest that is 3%, and that's what many people feel. That's where
the Chinese bank depositor, I definitely feel that pain.
Right, definitely.
Do you think that there may be a build-up in China of the same kind of anti-banker sentiment that we've been seeing in Europe and America, especially since the financial crisis?
The earnings of the bankers are not so visible compared to the Wall Street. So due to the bad disclosure, probably you can trace them. And the earnings they disclosed is not as high as in the Wall Street. So the hatred or the anger is not so much towards individuals rather than towards the industry as a whole. But on the other hand, banks still is the backbone of Chinese financial sector. So that's pretty much more than 80%, probably 70% or 80% finance is done by banks. And having said that, again, the profit is generated by the interest spread, which is a policy made by the government, not the banks themselves.
So on the public perception part of this, maybe that's something that I can speak to a little bit. The banks here as entities are much more closely tied to the government than their counterparts in the U.S. Well, than their counterparts in the U.S. used to be. The U.S. banks are a little bit more closely tied now than they were. And maybe that has shielded them a little bit from how they might have been viewed as purely private entities. But also they haven't been closely associated with with a vast national crisis in the same way that the U.S. banks have been. And they don't seem to suffer under the same – they don't seem to have the same perception problem that Wall Street in particular and the very biggest banks in the U.S. have. There's a – for whatever reason, there's a particular image that's been cultivated around Wall Street banks and the perception of their greed and, how they're putting themselves first. And we've seen this manifest in a whole lot of different ways in the U.S., in the Occupy Wall Street movement, in the very recent widely talked about op-ed in the New York Times from the gentleman who is resigning publicly from Goldman Sachs. I haven't seen anything like that here. Chinese banks have had a bailout from the state in the past a few years back. Were such a thing to happen again, and for that to coincide with a really severe economic slowdown, which it probably would, I suppose, then you might see that perception begin to shift. But they haven't been through the same kind of catalysts as the U.S. banks have, at least not in recent years.
But again, I think the major difference is, just like Will said, behind the Wall Street banks, people's perception is the drive is greed. But in China, whatever failure the bank will whatever difficulty the banks will eventually move into, behind that, the drive probably people will feel that's policy rather than greed.
Yeah, I guess the sort of the anger in China tends to be about corruption,
right,
rather than banks specifically.
That being said, public anger can get going at SOEs if they put their foot in the wrong place, and there's no reason it couldn't happen to a bank.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to our main topic, which is a pretty juicy one, I think, and something I think all of us have a fair bit of experience with, which is we've been calling paid journalism in our email correspondence, but I don't think that's quite the right term. What we're talking about is Chinese companies paying for media coverage in one way or another, right? So we've taken this topic really as from something that you recommended last week, Will, which was a piece in the New York Times. And perhaps you could start by just reintroducing that in a nutshell.
Sure. So that was an article by David Barboza, who's the Shanghai-based business reporter for the New York Times. And he wrote an article called In China, the Best Coverage Cash Can Buy, talking about a few issues with regards to companies' relationships with the media in China, but focusing a great deal on the fact that companies can pay for good coverage, essentially buying advertorials. But unlike, say, in the New York Times or in most Western media, it's not written, you know, it's not marked as an advertorial. It's not separated from regular editorial in any discernible way. So for all intents and purposes, it looks and feels like editorial rather than advertising. It's really advertising. It's a widespread problem here, depending on how you want to look at it. There's a lot of media that do it.
How widespread is it? I mean, maybe Lisa, you could help to answer this. How common is, let's look at the print media. How widespread is it in print media in China?
I don't know. I work for only two employers, CCTV and Caixin, and none of that actually has, well, for CCTV, I didn't accept any of this, and for Caixin, we have
You didn't see any of it, or you didn't accept it?
I didn't accept it.
So people offered?
And for disclosure, the only thing I took gifts from, the only time I took gifts from my interviewee back in CCTV when I was a documentary producer was when I interviewed the publishing house, Shangwu Yinshuguan, and they gave me three dictionaries, really heavy ones, and I took that because I like these dictionaries, and that's the only time.
Did other companies offer you money or gifts?
Whenever you go to the press conferences, and it's pretty common that people will give you an envelope that they call Che Ma Fei, that means covering your transportation. And I didn't take any of this because I was doing documentary. Actually, I didn't have any opportunity of doing this. But having said that, when I was working as a when I was a student and helped out with some of the press conferences as the organizer, as part of the organizing team, I know that we don't not only paying the journalists but also the drivers as well.
So I think it's when we're talking about this that it's very helpful to be clear about the different kinds of things that are happening. Because the advertorials are one thing.
Okay, right. Then let's list them out by the different kinds of things rather than by the media type. So number one is...
So the transportation claim, which Lisa mentioned, which is also widespread, paying 200 or 300 RMB to every journalist who attends an event or press conference. It's certainly been widespread as long as I've been here. The buying of advertorials that aren't marked. Also things that I would consider, neither of those is great. And neither of them helps trust in the media or helps development of the industry. There are worse things, including offering to withhold negative coverage for a fee. You'll get the call saying, we're working on this terrible story, but, you know, for a certain number of pages of advertising or some other consideration, it could go away.
And that's a phone call fee, right?
That's pretty much phone call fee, right? The third, I agree with Will completely, though. The third type is actually much worse. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, none of this is good, but... The blackmailing, it's more like blackmailing, that's actually worse.
And when journalists do that, do they start out with a mercenary motive? Do they start out saying, I'm going to dig up dirt on this company in order for us to blackmail them? Or does it happen where they just happen to stumble upon a story and somebody in the business department thinks, okay, light bulb, let's threaten them?
I don't know. That never happens to us.
That's why we read Caixin. I can't plug. I can't answer that either. You'd have to talk to some journalists who aren't in the room today. It does make sense to look at that in terms of what's happened to the media as an industry here over the last decade and a half or so, which is increasing commercialization and increasing competition on a revenue basis amongst media. Fierce competition to to get advertising dollars, fierce competition to drive revenue, a drying up of subsidies that used to support some of the media. And you combine that with, you know, the notoriously competitive and mercantile business environment here, and you can sort of, you can begin to see where some of this stuff emerges. It is good that there are media organizations emerging in the last few years in particular that eschew these kinds of practices. I think that's a very positive sign for the media here, but it's still quite widespread.
I don't think there are many, though. I
mean, no, it's the leading edge.
I've been on all sides of this because I was a partner in a design and advertising firm that one of the things we did for some clients was we organized press conferences. And we arranged for the transport fee to be paid because, as we understood it, you know, there were quite a few, a large number of journalists who simply would not ever go to a press conference without it. And we just did it. So I've been on the briber side of it. I've also been on the bribed side of it because I've been invited to press conferences for some reason. People think
you're just filthy every which way.
And I've usually taken the money and then not written anything about them, judge me.
Well,
but I've also sort of been observing it as a sort of media watcher in China. And it seems to me that the media industry in China is possibly one step above the coal mining industry in terms of morality. I think Cai Xin, and I believe your former colleagues at Caijing are maintaining a similar level of integrity from what I hear. But I mean, are there any other media organizations that you think are really clean?
A number of organizations actually have ethical codes. I mean, we certainly have that never accept anything like even tomafei or the transportation fee, and don't accept any money from the people you're going to interview, going to report upon. And also, as an editor or any reporter covering the finance sector, we cannot trade stocks. Or if we have mutual funds, we have to disclose every several months.
Yeah, but we know you're clean.
Yeah. I mean,
you got that reputation. Let's look at, you know, very far away from your office in China, generally speaking. I mean, how, you know.
It's a question of degrees. I think there are very few Chinese media organizations, and Cai Xin and Cai Jing are two of them, that adhere to what would be recognizable as, pardon me if I sound imperialist here, but Western media ethical standards, right?
You imperialist.
Thank you.
You.
I do think that there are other media that are beginning to distinguish themselves by having good reporting and good opinion. They haven't stepped up quite to the same level, but they're in sort of intermediate territory. And some of them are named here in this article, actually, because they still do things like running unmarked advertorials. But I do think of things like the Economic Observer and 21st Century yeah. Business Herald as being a cut above, most of the media in
right.
China in terms of their quality and in terms of the kind of reporting they do and their ethical standards. But they are in a transitional place in terms of the development of ethics and their professionalization. But it's still a small number.
It's still a small number. We've covered basically three types of paid journalism. Are there any more?
Those are the main ones that we have encountered. There probably are others. When I was in my agency days, did not encounter them regularly.
What would you say there are other models where people will, you know, get paid by a company for some kind of coverage or... aside from the three we talked about?
That's pretty much it. I mean, the transportation fee is neutral, and then the positive editorial and the negative withholding of the negative report. That's pretty much covered everything.
There have been straight-up blackmail cases.
Yeah.
You know, we're sniffing around. One is we've developed the story, buy some advertising, it'll go away. I mean, there have been cases where it's been reported to be possibly even grungier to that, whereas journalists showing up at the scene of a disaster and simply saying, well, you know, pay us and we'll go away. There have also been journalists who have been assaulted in China in those situations because they pulled that stunt on people like coal mine owners that, you know, are...
Don't have a sense of humor.
Don't have a sense of humor and are willing to go head-to-head with them on these kind of situations.
So, we've covered a few publications now that, you know, are signs of hope that this is getting better in China. Do you see it? Is it changing? Are these isolated examples, or is there a broader awareness amongst media professionals that this is not a good thing?
To be honest, my general feeling is it's changing for the worse, simply because the reason Will just mentioned, it's more market rise. There's more marketization of the whole industry. For the publications, the pressure to make profit is even more severe. And for individual journalists, the pay is not extremely high compared to the inflation, this and that. Having said that, the anecdotes we heard is actually some local city newspapers, which actually didn't have any business coverage before, set up a IPO section, pre-IPO section, just to blackmail the local blackmail companies who are aiming to a listing. Just threatening them, we're going to give a negative.
It's a mixed bag. I agree with Li Xin that as long as the commercial pressures keep going, these problems are going to continue and they're possibly going to get worse in some ways. At the same time, the rise of publications like Taixin and Taijing, and even the other ones I mentioned that are coming up, 21st Century Business Herald, Economic Observer, a few of the other better established newspapers, that's a good thing. You said something a few minutes ago, Jeremy, you said reputation, and that's important. If there are media in China that figure out that they can differentiate themselves and that they can earn trust by having better ethical standards, then that's a good thing, and hopefully others will follow. The problem with these practices isn't just that companies get victimized, it's that the media pisses away what trust it could be earning from the public. And this is a public that really could use some trusted voices, part of the reason why we see all the rumor. All the rumors flying around the internet here, and the government then attempts to suppress them, is that there is a shortage of trust in public discourse. If there are media that can do a better job of claiming that ground, that's a good thing. And it looks like, even if it's just a handful, some are doing that, and hopefully that'll pull more behind them. But it's not going to solve the industry-wide problem.
What about the internet, where there's a slightly different... Obviously, there are news portals that take money in the same way that print journalists. But aside from that, there's an industry in China of paid commenting, of people either, you know, using bots or you know, underpaid children in Henan to put spam comments.
Well, that raises actually what might have been considered the fourth kind of... It's not media, but maybe a related corrupt practices. And we've talked about this here on Seneca before, and that's black PR, paying for negative coverage of your competitors. And that we've seen, certainly we've seen it on the internet. We talked about that on Seneca when the dairy companies, Yili and Mengniu, were squaring off against one another. So that kind of thing has played out on the internet quite a bit.
The last time we did some research, you know, for Dangwei, we did some research for a client on this, and we figured out that there were about, we estimated there were 1,000 small PR firms, so-called PR firms, that offer paid commenting as a service. Does that figure sound about right to you?
Sounds low.
Sounds low, yeah.
You know, one of the things about paying for coverage and about, you know, paying to have your rivals slagged off on the internet or in print, which can also be done, I'm not sure about television, is it's easy. It's easier than earning real PR. If you can just write a check, if you can just hand over an envelope and get the coverage you need, why put the work into the rest of what we would consider normal PR? And as long as it's easy to do that, there's going to be firms that will provide the service.
Is China low on this? Actually, I'm curious. I mean, I'm not saying the paid journalism, by the paying internet.
No, astroturfing happens anywhere that the internet exists in different ways and forms. And so does the advertorial issue. Lou Hoffman, who's a PR pro who runs an eponymous agency that's based out of California, but does have offices here in Beijing and elsewhere in the region, wrote a post that for people who are interested in this issue might be worth as a follow-up read to David Barboza's article. He says, the New York Times story on journalism in China is much ado about nothing. For one thing, it's not that he thinks that the practice is good, but he doesn't think advertorials in and of themselves are the end of the world. But the other thing is he points out that these kind of problems are not unique to China. They are global. They afflict all different kinds of media, in particular industries, luxury travel especially. You see this all over the place. I myself, in my younger, wilder days, used to write articles for diving magazines, and it was very typical to get a paid-for trip to a resort with the expectation being that you were going to take luscious photographs and write a luscious article. It's not just here.
That's right. The writer Paul Theroux, who, you know, if you're not familiar with his book, his travel books, he's kind of a, you know, somebody you don't really want to run into on any of your travels, because he's kind of mean and he doesn't really, he's grouchy, doesn't like anyone around him.
But he is a good writer.
He's a very funny writer. And some of his, I found the funniest stories were when he was invited on a junket to go on, say, a cruise. And then he writes about it in a book and he spends, you know, the whole story slagging off the cruise and everybody on it, which is kind of like, I like to think the much more literary and worthwhile equivalent of me taking the Cho Mai Fei and they're not writing anything.
Well, you know, speaking as somebody who spent a long time in PR agencies, we never assumed we were going to get anything other than attendance out of the
Cho Mai Fei. But you need the attendance.
Clients are like, showing up.
How many people are going to be there?
Also, right. On the Paul Theroux thing, as a pre-recommendation, those who are interested could read his China book, Riding the Iron Rooster, which is fairly entertaining.
A good read. So to close off this topic then before we go into our last section, I mean, Lisa, you know, do you, in your current job, how do you get approached much right now?
Not much. I'm more an editor rather than a reporter these days, so no. And also...
And your reporters? Your reporters, do you think they get approached much?
Not much. I mean, the Caixin reputation, as you said, as you described, from Caixin to Caixin, we've been in this industry for... The team has been in this industry for longer than 10 years and has been very religious about this. So people know this.
They do actually know it.
Yeah, they do, and they respect them. And there was only one occasion that I approached advertisers to sell advertisement for the English magazine, and I got it. The reason I got it is probably because, number one, I'm an amateur selling advertisement. Number two, I tell them right away that we're not going to interview your boss. We are not putting any positive coverage of you into our magazine simply because you bought our advertisement. This is a pure advertisement. There's no editorial, this and that. They were surprised, and they think that we're really clean and living up to the standard. So that's a positive sign.
I'm an optimist. I think it's the whole evolution of media here is an ongoing process and a very interesting thing, a very interesting one to watch. I think it's a very good sign that journalists and media, at least parts of it, are becoming more professional. Some of them are, even if it's a small number. I believe that if change is going to happen in the industry, it's going to be the journalists within it that will drive it. Certainly not going to be Western media coverage or breastfeeding from people like me that's going to do it. It's going to be Chinese journalists that drive that change because they want to be professional and because they want to distinguish themselves by doing the kinds of things that publications like Caixin are doing. And I am hopeful that will happen to at least part of the industry. But I think it will be a long time before it happens to all of the industry.
It will be a long time, and let's keep our fingers crossed that the profits can still sustain this.
Yeah, let's keep our fingers crossed. Very much so. Let's move on to recommendations. Lisin, you got a good one for us.
I haven't got this book yet, but I heard about this book written by Wu Heping, the spokesperson for the Public Security Bureau. And I mean...
It's in Chinese, right?
It's in Chinese.
Not in English.
Yes,
so.
It's in Chinese. I don't know if they has an English version of it. But this person, he probably will retire soon. What do you expect from somebody who is going to retire is more honest words. So he did a chronicle of review of some of the public incidents we heard in the last several years and describe what's behind the scene, basically, how these people are tackling that from a PR perspective. Like, in one incident, I remember in the Shishou where tens of thousands of people took the street, and he described that.
In where was that, sorry?
In Shishou.
Shishou?
Yeah. And then I remember in the book he said the county chief simply lost his words for 10 hours. And that was one of the reasons that it was a slow, very slow response. And also, one example you'll remember vividly was the after the train crash last year, the spokesperson from the railway ministry came out and did a disastrous press conference.
The famous
Wang Yongping.
Yeah, right.
Right.
I don't know if you believe it or not, but I believe it.
Exactly, right. Exactly. So basically, we're hoping to give more details behind it. It's like this guy, the spokesperson, Mr. Wang, didn't prepare at all. He didn't have a team to prepare him for that, and he didn't got briefed before he goes into the press conference.
So the poor guy had no idea
what
was going on.
He had absolutely no idea and before he came into this room.
Yeah, I've got to say, I mean, I wouldn't like to be a spokesperson for any Chinese government organization in a time of crisis. Thanks. That's so can you get that online or in bookstores? Or?
Yeah, I saw that on Amazon and a couple of other online bookstores.
Okay, we'll put a link to it.
And
on,
the Chinese
on the
name
webpage.
For that is 打开天窗说亮话.
Open the window
and speak
say,
frankly.
Speak frankly. Like right. Will, what you got for us?
So my recommendation this week is an article on American Public Media's Marketplace by the journalist Rob Schmitz. You, well, Seneca listeners will remember him because he was on the show a couple of weeks ago talking about the...
How he bust Mike Daisy's ass.
Indeed. I'm less interested in that than I am interested in the nuance of manufacturing in China and what high-tech manufacturing really means to people and workers in the economy here and how it's perceived here as opposed to how it's perceived in the West, which I think is sometimes in starker terms than it should be. So he had a report up today called The People Behind Your iPad, The Workers, based on his recent visit to Foxconn, where he went and he spoke to workers in the factory. It was an authorized visit where he put together some video of product assembly in Foxconn. And I think it's very, very interesting because it is a somewhat more nuanced and human look at the workers there, where they talk about what they're getting out of it and what their expectations are and what's good about it and what's bad about it. And because of that, I think it's worth having a look at. So it's on marketplace.org by Rob Schmitz, and the article is called The People Behind Your iPad, The Workers.
Fantastic. I've got one which is a Chinese website and podcast done by a Chinese ethnomusicologist named Xiao Shi, and it's ourfolk.net, folk as in folk music, ourfolk.net /radio is where the podcast is. And much of it is his own recordings. Some of it is from other recorded sources. But there are episodes, for example, about places in Xinjiang where there's an hour and a half of mostly music, some of it originally recorded, very high quality sound, the most beautiful music, and short introductions in Chinese by Xiao Shi. But even if you can't speak Chinese, most of it is music and it's worth listening to. That's ourfolk.net/radio. Really special thing. And on that note, thank you very much, Lee Sin, for coming over tonight on your busy night. And I hope to see you again soon.
Right. Hope to talk to you again soon.
And thanks, Will.
Always a pleasure.